This is the Nichols-Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments Podcast for the week of November the 10th, 2014. This podcast is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols-Patrick CPA Incorporated. Any use of the audio of this podcast without the express written consent of your State Society of CPAs and Nichols-Patrick CPA Incorporated is prohibited. We're going to go ahead and take a look this week at what's been developing in the various areas of taxation, federal taxes specifically, during the current week. And frankly, with the election this week and the fact that the federal government's fiscal year ended the prior week, not surprisingly, not a whole lot happened this week as Washington was focused on other issues. But we do have a few things, so we're going to talk about those issues as we move forward. First, the IRS issued on November the 4th, Notice 2014-69. This notice is meant to handle an issue that the IRS, Department of Labor, and Department of Health and Human Services believe they have uncovered with regard to the Affordable Care Act. The issue in this question deals with some programs that those agencies have become aware of that have been marketed to employers that, using the calculator available on the HHS website, which purports to tell us if a program offers minimum value, have determined that some programs they designed, which do not offer significant benefits for inpatient hospitalization nor significant benefits for physician visitation, nevertheless could meet the mechanical requirements on that website for offering minimum value. As you should be aware, for employers next year who are quote-unquote large employers, and that's a definition where you look at having had on average 50 employees during the preceding year, so for most employers that will be for 2014, in that case, if they do not offer a program that is both affordable and offers minimum value, and any employee receives a benefit from the exchange where we get either a subsidy or qualify for a credit, that employer will owe a penalty based under the pay or play rules. This concept of minimum value is one of those that has to be part of the program. And so, of course, in theory, by offering this program, which provides a minimum value and presumably is going to be less expensive than alternatives, the employer would both have been able to claim they offered to all employees a program that offered minimum value and was affordable and by definition would not be subject to the penalty. The departments have determined, and they're going to issue regulations to clarify this fact, that plans that do not offer significant inpatient hospitalization or significant physician visitation coverage are not appropriately, in the view of these agencies, deemed as offering minimum value, and such programs will be treated as not offering minimum value under the new regulations. The IRS does realize that some employers may have already signed up for such programs and be involved in binding commitments where they will have to offer such a program next year. They've agreed to take that on. Therefore, this notice provides that if an employer entered into a binding agreement with a third party to offer this coverage for 2015, that the employer will not be deemed not to offer minimum value on such coverage for 2015 only. Now, this is only true if the employer's plan year begins on or before March 1st of 2014. If the plan begins after that date, the IRS's theory is the employer now just needs to go out and find a revised program, or the employer is going to end up facing the potential for the penalties under the pay or play rule. Next up, we have a technical advice memorandum here, 2014-45010. That was issued on November the 7th. And this deals with the question of the Section 199 deduction for production. Remember that one where we look at whether or not we have a deduction to allow us to take off of our income the lesser of our net income from production, domestic production, or our taxable income. In this case, the question involved a software developer. Now, software development is generally considered to be domestic production under Section 199. However, providing services is not considered to be domestic production. And we ran into an issue here with a software developer. And this is an issue where we were looking at an issue where the agents who were involved on the case obviously believed this particular taxpayer was offering a service or being receiving income that was service that would not be domestic production gross receipts. In this particular case, the software developer licensed software to what it called a contracting party. The contracting party used this software to perform services for third parties. Those services were basically, they provided a service, they would use the software, perform the service for third parties. Every time this contracting party used the service to provide this, use the software to provide this service to the third party, a payment would go to the software developer. The agents on the exam said what was being paid for here was clearly the service that was being provided, and because of that, they felt that, in fact, this was not domestic production gross receipts, but rather was non-domestic production gross receipts. It was the other parts of gross receipts. The taxpayer obviously believed that it was part of domestic production gross receipts and, of course, was arguing that they should be able to get their deduction. So the issue went up with a request for technical advice to the national office. The national office in this case sided with the taxpayer. It found it was domestic production gross receipts. The chief counsel advice specifically discussed three examples under the regulations under section 1.99-3I6V. Those three examples, the agents on the exam felt, showed that this was a service provider structure. However, the memorandum points out that, in fact, in the view of the agency, that rather than having provided services to a third party and really used software that was internally developed, this entity had actually licensed out software to an independent party. That party was providing services, and obviously that party's not going to qualify for the domestic production gross receipts inclusion for any income it receives. But the mere fact that the licensing was being paid for on the basis of how often that third party used it did not change this from a licensing arrangement for the software. Thus, the national office concluded this company could treat this as domestic production gross receipts. The IRS in Treasury Decision 9700 issued effectively to be published Monday on the 10th, but actually preliminarily published here last Friday. Treasury Decision 9700 deals with issues regarding what happens to earnings and profits when you have a corporate, when you have a liquidation of a subsidiary or a corporate reorganization. This revises the regulations under 381. And under these rules, the IRS has concluded revising those regulations pretty much went in line with what they had proposed in the proposed regulations. Generally, the corporation that acquires the assets of the transferring corporation in either a liquidation of a subsidiary under 312 or any of the various reorganizations under 368, you know, all those neat things from type A through type G reorganizations, in that case, the acquiring corporation will go ahead and pick up the earnings and profits of the distributing corporation. There will be no allocation of earnings and profits, even if this particular receiving corporation does not actually keep any of the assets ultimately at the end of the day when we finish up with the transaction. Rather, the E&P comes to that organization. The only exception will be for corporate separations that qualify for treatment under Regulation 1.312-10. Otherwise, no allocation. These regulations are effective for transactions taking place on or after November the 10th of 2014. That is the day on which these final regulations took effect. So as noted, if you have any transactions occurring on or after that date, you will need to go ahead and take care of them under these particular procedures rather than any procedures you had in place before. Next comes up is the case of Cantor versus Commissioner. Tax Court Summary Opinion 2014-103. The interesting aside under this provision deals with a case of a real estate professional. Now, we've had a lot of cases come up under whether somebody was truly properly treated as a real estate professional under the regulations under 469 of the Code. In this case, this gentleman ran a sole proprietorship. Now, generally under Section 469, to be a real estate professional qualified under 469C7, you must show that more than one half of your personal services for the year in question were performed in trader businesses during such taxable years that were real estate trader businesses. And under the regulation, a real property construction or reconstruction activity. In this, I started out doing essentially windshield work for cars. Actually, it started out earlier as some residential glass work including work on new construction and doing simple things like doors, replacing all kinds of issues or problems that may occur with glass in a home. So he clearly had far more than 750 hours in that particular trade or business. The question the IRS raised was they didn't think that Mr. Cantor had shown. The IRS noted that while he had records of the hours that he had taken place in his doing or how much of his time was devoted to the portion of the business for the window management for the entity, or even among the home and residential work, how much construction or reconstruction, and how much represented just basically repair work. That was over half of his time. The tax court found a couple of things qualify. In fact, the tax court didn't even concede that any of the residential work would qualify as construction or reconstruction. Dictionary definition for the terms. But they determined that even if we assume the they indicated that clearly if you were just replacing panes of glass you wanted it replaced, that would not qualify for these purposes. Secondly, the court burden is on the taxpayer to show that he meets the requirements here. Mr. Cantor was unable, as such, he could not be a real estate professional, and as such, any of his rental losses would be denied. This is yet another case where taxpayers attempting to get treatments under passive active documentation. Reality is taxpayers are losing this quite often. That depends on the issue out there. Number two, the consistency with which taxpayers lose in this case means they are not going to prevail. And advisors also need to be aware that they need to inquire of taxpayers to attempt to hold preparers liable if, in fact, they are penalized, taxes claiming that they should have been told had they been told they would have kept the records. Even if a client says advisors have a different problem because advisors have a requirement under 6694 of the code and even under Circular 230 that you have to have support disclosure, it does not appear that a taxpayer who does not have any records to back this up had the advisor merely told them how important it was to make sure that information was the case of Reisner versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014. Had attempted to make a charitable contribution of a facade easement. Now, he had made, by the time we get to this point, that in fact the easement had no value, and 2006. For 2004 and 2005, the IRS penalty, that in essence that he had a gross valuation misstatement, I should say, and that normally would have qualified the taxpayer for an immediate. However, for those 2 years, you could get out of that penalty by showing the IRS agreed the taxpayer had reasonable cause and acted in good faith in 2004 and 2005, that due to the charitable contribution limits, it carried forward to 5, no problem, effective for returns filed after July 25th of 2006, that valuation misstatement penalties. Now we get down to the 2006 return, I'll be held subject to it. There was a reasonable cause, the valuation occurred in 2006, the tax court pointed out that Congress intentionally said for returns filed after July 25, 2006 return in 2007, and continuing to carry forward the values and valuation that was overstated. That was what was being penalized, not a retroactive penalty back to the years prior to that. When the taxpayer filed the 6% penalty, regardless of reasonable cause, once they went ahead and took that carryover. The current federal tax developments for the week of November 10th, 2014.